The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Thank you, Peter. Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Great to see you this morning. Well done for being here early. Let's begin. You may have heard of Richard Wurmbrand. Richard and his wife Sabina worked, well, he was a pastor in an underground church in Romania during the time of communist Russian occupation. The Russians occupied from 44 through to 58. He was put in prison a number of times, tortured, etc. Ended up writing a book called Tortured for Christ, which has been a worldwide bestseller. And he started the organisation The Voice of the Martyrs later. In his book, Tortured for Christ, he has this story. Now, some of you may have heard this before. If you haven't, please think about it. He says this: when Russians occupied Romania, two armed Russian soldiers entered the church with their guns in their hands. They said, "We don't believe in your faith. Those who do not abandon it immediately will be shot at once. Those who do abandon your faith, move to the right." Some moved to the right. They were ordered to leave the church and go home. They fled for their lives. Okay, if you're a follower of Jesus, I know we're not all necessarily that. If you're a follower of Jesus, would you stay? Should you stay? The best I can say is, I hope I would stay. Okay, I hope I would stay. The story continues. When the Russians were alone with the remaining Christians, they embraced them and told them, "We too are Christians, but we wish to have fellowship only with those who consider the truth worth dying for." I would have thought the next few minutes would be a little awkward. That's why I just... Anyway, I can imagine. Now, we come today to the theme of religious persecution, or particularly the persecution of those who believe the Bible, those who follow Jesus. And let's have a look at what this particular story from the Old Testament, and then I'd like to think with you about some implications of what the New Testament says. Now, in the book of Daniel, there's two stories, particularly about the miraculous rescue of those who will not compromise in their faith in God. And they're the stories that launched 1,000 Sunday school lessons. There's Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego in the fiery furnace, and Daniel and the lion's den. Well, let's try and put this into context and have a think about it as adults rather than children in Sunday school. To put it in context, if you haven't been here the last couple of weeks, in 605 BC, Nebuchadnezzar, who was the new ruler of the Babylonian Empire, conquered Jerusalem. Actually, he conquered it about, they conquered it three times over the next 15 years, as Jerusalem wouldn't settle down and be submissive. In that first conquest, Nebuchadnezzar took the cream of the crop, the young, the educated, the beautiful, took them back to Babylon. Caught up in that were Daniel and his three friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They were taken to Babylon. Here's some artist's impressions of what the city would have looked like. It really was the most amazing city in the ancient world, as the river Euphrates ran through the middle of the city. Massive walls, beautifully laid out, etc. A lot of it now in museums. It's been taken back to Europe, etc., by archaeologists. Nebuchadnezzar had a huge empire, as you can see, from up into Turkey, across into Iran or Persia, then Egypt, up to the top of where Saudi Arabia is now. How do you govern that? Well, you take the best and the brightest, you put them into some kind of education system, and they help you. Daniel and his three friends are conscripted into a kind of almost a Rhodes scholarship. At the end of that, they're to work for the king in his royal service. Daniel ends up doing that for around 65 or more years. Now, let me show you the structure. As these four young men, who later become old men, work in the Babylonian system, serve the king, but do not give up their faith or trust in the God of Israel. The book of Daniel is very carefully structured. Chapters 2 to 7, well, let me show you how that. Chapter 1 is an introduction, just kind of introduces the scene. And then chapters 2 and 7... are parallel with one another. They're both visions of the future and four great kingdoms that are to come, and then God's kingdom. And then today we'll look at 3 and 6, which are parallel to one another, the issue of persecution and rescue. And next week we'll pick up chapter 4. 4 and 5 are parallel. The way that's structured, the theologians call it a chiastic structure, it's meant to focus on the forgive the expression, the filling of the sandwich, as you can see, which is the idea of God humbling the rulers of Babylon. 3 and 6 are parallel, both about persecution. Now, let me show you how 3 and 6 are parallel. I'll just walk you through it very quickly. And that's, I'm not looking at chapter 6 because it's so close to chapter 3. In each chapter, there's an ultimatum. You will bow down or you'll die. There's a refusal to compromise. The Jewish men are informed on by those who are resentful. There's an audience with the king. They're cast into the furnace or the lion's den, miraculously rescued, and then the king acknowledges the God of Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, and Daniel. So that's the structure, and it's very carefully written together. So let's have a look at chapter 3 and then look at some of the implications. In your handout is most of Daniel chapter 3. I'll read it quickly. You'll get the idea. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold 60 cubits high. That's 90 feet, about 30 metres. And 6 cubits wide, 9 feet wide, 3 metres. And set it up in the plain of Jura in the province of Babylon. The plain of Jura was like a suburb of the city of Babylon. So you've got an image about the height of a 9-story building, something like that. Would look, it's very narrow, it's not in a human form necessarily, it's kind of an obelisk thing. Now, why an image of gold? Well, we saw last week Nebuchadnezzar had a dream where he, of a great statue indicating 4 kingdoms, the head of gold was him. So he set this up as gold. Now, why did he do this? It's not necessarily... Yes, it's religion, but it's much more in the service of politics. I'll give you an example of today. The Indian government in the last month has unveiled this statue. It is 600 feet high. Now, I don't know if you can see the screen. Can you see the ants down at the feet of the statue? They are the workers. It's 100 times as tall as the men working on it. The statue depicts... Forgive me for murdering the pronunciation. The statue depicts Sardar Patel, who together with Gandhi and Nehru helped lead India to independence from the United Kingdom. And the statue is called the Statue of Unity. It's all about national unity. And it's big. It's big. And what's Nebuchadnezzar doing? Well, for Nebuchadnezzar, the idea is, yes, it's religion, but it's all about everyone will bow down and acknowledge his authority. You can have your own God, sure, but this one comes first. So, verse 2. Then the king summoned the satraps, prefects, governors, advisors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all the other provincial officials to come to the dedication of the image he had set up. And, of course, they turn up. Verse 4. Then the herald loudly proclaimed, "Nations and peoples of every language, this is what you are commanded to do. As soon as you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipe, and all kinds of music, you must fall down and worship the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. Whoever does not fall down and worship will immediately be thrown into a blazing furnace." And so, not surprisingly, they all fall down and worship. This thing that is a symbol of Nebuchadnezzar, his empire, his power. Except for 3 young men who don't. Now, I'm assuming the crowds were so big the king didn't see this directly. They are, Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego are informed on. Verse 12, they're told, there's a hint of anti-Semitism here as well, I think. Verse 12, "But there are some Jews," they say to the king, "whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego," and I say a hint because I think it's just plain old jealousy in a way, "who pay no attention to you, your majesty. They neither serve your gods nor worship the image of gold you have set up." Nebuchadnezzar is furious, has them brought to him, threatened with the furnace. And the archaeologists have found brick kilns or furnaces like this around Babylon as they have excavated the ruins. Here's what Joyce Baldwin says in her excellent little commentary. The example that they've found, it resembles a railway tunnel blocked at one end but with an entrance at the other. Uprights at frequent intervals support the dome and serve as ventilation shafts also. Charcoal provides the heat, and it's estimated that the temperature would have reached around 900 to 1,000 degrees Celsius. So this is an example of what they're threatened with. "We will throw you in here." And in verse 15, Nebuchadnezzar says, "And what God will save you then?" So verse 16, what do the young men say? "Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego replied to him, 'King Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to deliver us from it. and he will deliver us from your majesty's hand. But even if he does not, we want you to know, your majesty, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up. Now, why? Why? Take some courage to say that. Well, the Old Testament law that Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego were brought up on is very clear. If you want a summary statement in the Ten Commandments, here's the Ten Commandments, although they weren't originally given in English. That's not the original, you know, okay. First commandment, I don't know if anyone can remember, first commandment is, yeah, you shall have no, that's it, you shall have no other gods before me. That's it. So the God of Israel says, that's it, only worship me. Now the second commandment is about how you should worship that one true God. You shall not make for yourself a carved image of or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or is in the earth beneath, or is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them. These young guys, it is very clear, they cannot bow down to this. And you notice what they say is, our God is able to save us, and somehow he'll take us out of your hand, but even if he doesn't, we still won't bow down. Now that really pushes the king's buttons. He heats up the kiln extra hot, and verse 24, they're thrown into the fire, and then verse 24, then King Nebuchadnezzar leapt to his feet in amazement and asked his advisers, weren't there three men that we tied up and threw into the fire? They replied, certainly, your majesty. He said, look, I see four men walking around in the fire, unbound and unharmed, and the fourth looks like a son of the gods. A massive amount of ink spilt over who this fourth person is. Simple answer is, we don't know. Nebuchadnezzar then approached the opening of the blazing furnace and shouted, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out, come here. So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the fire, and the satraps, prefects, governors, royal advisers crowded around them. They saw that the fire had not harmed their bodies, nor was a hair on their head singed. Their robes were not scorched, and there was no smell of fire on them. And Nebuchadnezzar said, praise be to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, who has sent his angel and rescued his servants. They trusted in him and defied the king's command and were willing to give up their lives rather than serve or worship any god except their own God. And then Nebuchadnezzar sends out a decree with his usual level of kind of finesse, I guess we'd say. Therefore, I decree that people of any nation or language who say anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be cut into pieces and their houses turned into piles of rubble, for no other God can save in this way. And the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. Okay, there's the story. It's simple to understand. Two questions. First one's this. Did God actually rescue these people? Like, did this happen? Okay. Well, there are, as far as I'm aware, there is no historical record of this particular event outside the Old Testament. It's easily understood that the Babylonians later would not record this. It's awkward for them. What you can do, though, is put together the pieces that the historical, what's happening around this actually fits. So, for example, we've already seen that the brick kilns, etc., existed. There's records of Nebuchadnezzar and another Babylonian king executing people by throwing them into the fire. What about the big statue? Joyce Baldwin, as I said, if you want to read on Daniel, she's a wonderful scholar, this lady. The statue, was it 90 feet high or 60 cubits? That's too big for them to build. No, the Colossus of Rhodes was 70 cubits high. There's records of overlaying statues with gold, etc. So it fits the scene, if you like. Largely whether or not you can believe this depends on your attitude to the Bible and your attitude to whether or not there is a God who is able to intervene in his creation. And so where we do dig up something and it bumps up against the Bible's shown to be reliable. Jesus certainly endorses the book of Daniel. Jesus' main self-understanding and the title that he takes, Son of Man, comes from Daniel chapter 7. So I guess what I'd say is this. Why do I believe this? Overall, wherever I can check, the package holds water. And so in this case, I'd say, maybe not hold water, holds fire, if you like, okay? But I take it to be reliable. Now, what the Bible does say generally is, it doesn't lead us to assume that God will intervene this way, though. Plenty of faithful people in the Bible who are actually killed for their faith. John the Baptist, Stephen, the first Christian martyr, James, who's the brother of John, is executed by King Herod. We know later James, the brother of Jesus, is murdered by the Jewish high priest, etc., around 60 AD. So it happens. And today it happens. So 2014 in Pakistan, I just thought this one I'd say because this is one where the fire did burn those who were Christian, those who served God. A young couple who were mistakenly thought to have burned part of the Quran, and there's a mob, and then they're killed and their bodies burned, and they're not sure what order they were killed or burned in, but that happened in 2014. Do you notice what's Daniel showing? I think Daniel, the book of Daniel, is showing that God is able to intervene. This does not happen outside of God's control. And so, as they say in verse 17, but even if he doesn't, or our God is able, but even if he doesn't, we still won't bow down. Okay. Happy to take questions, comments in a moment. Second question, though. Why are the followers of Jesus persecuted? Why does it happen? It's worth saying this. Christians do not have a monopoly. Christians do not have a monopoly on being persecuted. We shouldn't think, you know, if you're a follower of Jesus, don't think, why me? It's in human nature to persecute minority groups. And so, in the past, people who are homosexual, or the history of anti-Semitism is awful, or racism, it's just part of the human condition. But what the New Testament does promise is, if you follow Jesus, there will be times when it will cost you. So the Apostle Paul writes to Timothy in what probably is Paul's last letter, and certainly while Paul is in prison being persecuted for his faith in Jesus, he says, in fact, everyone who wants to live a godly life in Christ Jesus will be persecuted. You don't have to go looking for it. It will come to you if you're a follower of Jesus. And you see it loud and clear in the world today in different ways. So, for example, Nebuchadnezzar, its political power to suppress people, North Korea. I understand from reading in North Korea, if you're caught with a Bible, the government will actually put three generations of your family in prison or in a concentration camp. That's if you're not executed. So parents, yourself, your children, if you're just caught with the Bible. The missionary organisation Open Doors lists 50 countries around the world, and you can see the hot spots, no surprise. 50 countries around the world where you can be beaten, imprisoned or killed for following Jesus. The organisation started by Richard Wurmbrand, the Voice of the Martyrs, also lists 50 countries. You can see mainly Islamic countries, but also there's still some remnants of communism. In fact, they even have a global report that's available on their website for free, where they'll take you through those 50 countries and explain in detail the cost of being Christian, the dangers in those countries. I don't know if you've been following the news story in Pakistan of Asia Bibi, who I think she drank a glass of water in the wrong way or something, and then has been accused of blasphemy against the Prophet Muhammad, and she has spent 8 years on death row. She has just been released from prison and is in fear of her life from, quote, extremists, and now is a question of whether any country has the testicular fortitude to offer her refuge. But I think it's still undecided. Now, why is it, though, if it's that common, why is it we don't hear about it in the media? In the mainstream media, this is almost never reported. I don't think it's a conspiracy. A friend of mine always taught, always assume incompetence rather than conspiracy on anything. But I don't think it's a conspiracy. I think it's this. It just doesn't fit the narrative. The narrative is that Christianity is still white and Western, and Christianity is more the imperial, you know, the imperialist rather than the persecuted. Also, persecution is usually interpreted through a political grid rather than being religious persecution. And perhaps the main reason is this. It's just not that newsworthy. If it happens all the time and it happens in poor countries, it doesn't make the news. As I've said before, a poor person persecuted for their faith in Africa is not as newsworthy as dog ride surfboard at Bondi. Now, in this country, persecution, well, it's pretty mild compared to these 50. It's still here, and I don't mean to trivialise it, but it's not nothing like some other countries. For me personally, very soft. I mean, really, for me, what? My wife's family are Chinese, high achievers, business people, etc., not Christian. And I said to Kathy the other day, my wife, I said, I feel like the village idiot at your family get-togethers because I'm a clergyman. And she said, oh, no, honey, that's not the reason. exact quote. Now, I make light of it, but persecution can be real in this country. So, for example, there was a young woman dismissed from her job during the plebiscite campaign about same-sex marriage. Why? She worked for a woman that ran children's parties, and this girl put on her Facebook page, "It's okay to say no." Well, obviously, it's not okay to say no. She was dismissed. Or you may have noticed if you read the Australian front page on the weekend, religious freedom lost as magazine shuts, and that's White Magazine, which is a magazine about weddings and etc. They've decided to close it now. It depends on whether you read the Australian, which says religious freedom lost, or the ABC. The Australian says this is a case of persecution and religious freedom being denied by activists who've undermined the magazine. The ABC says there was a photographer who called them out in their hypocrisy. Very different reporting, but it's there and it's real. It can cost to follow Jesus in the workplace. Some of you may know more about that than me, no doubt. But the issue is complicated. Is it persecution, or is it the Christian organisations and Christian people losing the privileges that we had as Christendom disappears? It's complicated. I think certainly the way the wind's blowing, it will cost more to be a genuine follower of Jesus in this country as time goes on. I'm wishing that Michael Callaghan was here for Freedom for Faith. They're doing a great job, and if Michael was here, we could ask him more details about the current political situation, but I'll leave it at that. Now, if you open up your program, what I've done, I'm about to rush through something. The New Testament actually expects, Jesus teaches and the apostles teach, to expect persecution if you are a follower of Jesus, to expect that it will cost to follow him. I've just put together 11, it's not comprehensive, but 11 things that the New Testament says about why followers of Jesus may suffer for that and how they should respond. Let me walk you through that really quickly. Then you may want to have a look at this, talk about it on your tables, and I'm happy to have comments, questions, etc. Here we go. Take a deep breath. One, people hated Jesus, and if you carry the name of Jesus and live consistently, you should expect the same thing. John chapter 15. So Jesus never did anything wrong, and they hated him. We won't get it exactly right, so expect it if you're a follower of Jesus. Secondly, governments or rulers may persecute Christians because Christians do not acknowledge their authority as the ultimate or final authority. Christians serve another king, namely Jesus. That is why the Romans began to persecute the Christians. Three, the followers of Jesus should live a different life, different ethics, different moral values to many people, and so will be persecuted or mocked. Notice I said should. The followers of Jesus will not always get it right, but we should live a different life. And so that means we'll stand out, and it's the nail that sticks up that gets hit. Number four, it's a supernatural thing as well. It's the work of the devil to oppose God and to persecute those who belong to Jesus. You see that particularly in the book of Revelation, but in other parts of the New Testament. Now, there's some of the reasons why. If you look at point five, how should the followers of Jesus react to persecution because they carry his name? How should they react? Well, in Matthew chapter 5, Jesus says, this is in the Sermon on the Mount, that those who suffer or are falsely persecuted because of him will be greatly rewarded in heaven. He's saying that God greatly appreciates that. You will be greatly rewarded. Point six, this is kind of comforting. anyway, it is, yes. Jesus says, don't be afraid of those who can only kill the body. That we should fear or listen to him, namely God, who is able to throw soul and body into hell. And that God holds the ultimate destiny of people in his hands. It's Matthew chapter 10. Why would God allow persecution or suffering to those who follow Jesus? Point seven. Persecution or suffering can act as a refiner's fire or to refine or purify faith of those who follow Jesus. So suffering for the name of Jesus will actually clarify and purify motives and faith, etc. Point eight, and this is particularly relevant in today's climate, I think. Christians should make sure that they do not suffer because they've done wrong and deserve it. Christians should suffer for the name of Jesus, not because of wrong that they have done. Or if I could paraphrase it a little, don't suffer because you've been a goose. Okay, that's to be wise. Make sure it's not because you've done something wrong or stupid. Point nine, the followers of Jesus should not return persecution, quote, in kind, but trust the ultimate justice of God. It's worth reading what Peter says there in 1 Peter 2. He says this, to this you were called, because Christ suffered for you, leaving you an example that you should follow in his steps. When they hurled their insults at him, he did not retaliate. When he suffered, he made no threats. Instead, he entrusted himself to him who judges justly. And so the example of Jesus as he's persecuted, as he goes to the cross. 10. When there is an opportunity to explain the hope that Christians have, it should be done with gentleness and respect. Why? Well, two reasons, I think. One is that if you're sure you're right, you don't need to shout. You don't need to de-platform people, which is the latest tactic or the latest word. If you're sure you're right, you can speak. You don't need to shout. And secondly, the Christian person should be interested in winning the person, not just the argument. In winning the person, not just the argument. And then 11, a willingness to suffer for the name of Jesus points to the great division that will come on the day when God judges the world and all people. All right. Now, there's 11 points. I'd invite you perhaps to have a look through that. And Peter, there's the opportunity to ask questions or make comments.
There is indeed.
Or discussion on the tables. I think I've finished a minute or two early. It's a miracle. Okay, folks, some good questions as usual. The good news is I think I can answer one of them too. It's a good question, and I've thought of it myself, and people have asked me, what was Daniel doing when chapter 3 of the events were occurring? I guarantee one thing, he wasn't bowing down, but we're at the end of chapter 2. When Daniel interprets the dream for the king, Daniel's promoted. I actually think chapter 2 happens during their internship, their 3 years. Daniel's promoted, and then Daniel remembers his mates, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And we're told this. Then the king placed Daniel in a high position and lavished many gifts on him. He made him ruler over the entire province of Babylon and placed him in charge of all its wise men. Moreover, at Daniel's request, the king appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego administrators over the province of Babylon, while Daniel himself remained at the royal court. So the province of Babylon is, you know, the suburbs, the plain outside of the city. Daniel worked in the royal court. Best I can work out is they were working in slightly different areas. So Daniel just wasn't there that particular day. That's the best clue we get from the text. When the heat is on, why have Christians gone to water when it comes to defending Asia Bibi? Yeah, it's interesting. Look, I'll fess up. She's been on death row for 8 years. I've only understood that for the last few months that she was there. It just hasn't been widely reported in the Western media, and now that I know there's politicians, I think it was Boris Johnson who came out and said, you know, we should offer this girl asylum. And there are a whole lot of politicians there going to water saying, oh, we can't do that. I'll tell you why, because they're afraid of militant Islam in their own countries. And so that's why. The Pakistani legal system has set her free because the case wasn't proven. But she's in danger of her life now from those who would kill her outside of the legal system. I think in the Western world, we have it, Christians, followers of Jesus, have it so soft And I'm guilty here too. We just have trouble remembering or engaging or imagining what it is like for millions who live under really harsh conditions. Comment on note 6. Do not be afraid of those who kill the body but cannot kill the soul. Rather be afraid of the one who can destroy both soul and body in hell. That is a favourite verse of the imam at Korobokan prison, who converted to Christianity through Andrew Chan. Yes, I don't know that particular story, but I do remember when Andrew Chan and Maran Sukaran were executed, they faced death with great bravery. That's not a case of religious persecution, it's a case of the state exercising, well, you call it justice if you want. But they face death very bravely. It makes a genuine faith in Jesus makes a very big difference at the pointy end of life. Throughout history and around the world, some Christians have not sought persecution but accepted it with joy as a gift from God, as per 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 6. Are they deluded? Or have they received some special ability to handle it, or some other reason? I suspect it is that God gives you, for those who have genuine faith, God gives you the strength to cope with what you're given. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 13 says you won't be tested beyond what you can bear, beyond what you can cope with. And so I think that's the case. It's interesting that it seems to me it's not persecution that is a dangerous thing for the followers of Jesus. It's wealth and comfort. That's what I can't bring myself to say, please, Lord, send the persecution. I haven't ever prayed that. But given the way that Christianity is in the Western world, I can understand why God may make things a little sharper and a little harder here. So I think God does give the strength as required. Sometimes persecution makes the church grow and makes Christians active. They stop fighting with each other, and being a Christian becomes something with that people are willing to take seriously, because those who live as Christians take it seriously. But there have been other parts of the world where the persecution has been so severe that there are just no Christians left in the area. Here we go. What insights do we have as to when God will choose to rescue persecuted Christians and when he will not? That's interesting. God does as he chooses, I guess I would say. I'd like to think about this one a little more. But it's interesting that Peter is rescued in Acts chapter 10, miraculously. And then we know later that he's executed almost certainly in Rome and chooses to die there. The Apostle Paul is rescued from persecution, etc., again and again, and then is later executed in around 64 under Nero. It seems to me that with those who have a particular mission from God, sometimes when their job is done, God will take them away. And that seems to be what happens with John the Baptist. A sad story, but when John's job was done, God took him away from the picture, so that the focus would be on Jesus. It's interesting that I need to quote Rodney Stark again. Peter, please forgive me. Rodney Stark's book, The Rise of Christianity, the second half of that is some of the best stuff I've ever read on how the Christian faith grew. He says one of the major factors in the growth of the Christian faith in the second half of the first century was the fact that both Peter and Paul, the two most obvious leaders of the faith, were prepared to die for their faith. And when you're prepared to die for something, it gives you great credibility that you are genuine, sincere, etc. And so in the mid-60s, Stark thinks Christianity was at a tipping point, kind of was in the balance, and the fact that both of those stepped up and were prepared to die when probably they could have avoided it if they'd really wanted to, that made a massive difference. And so why does God rescue some and not others? God does as he chooses. Often in hindsight, you can see the reason why. Chapter 3, verses 5 and 7 and 10, the sound of the flute, horns, zither, harp, and all kinds of music. This was hardly a... mean, this is hardly a Nokia ringtone. Surely it must have been some sort of cacophony. Yeah, there's some debate in the commentaries about is it kind of a synchronized orchestra or not, and what that's all about. To be honest, I didn't read enough about it. I went past it. But please forgive me. If you're really interested, I'll point you to the pages where in the commentary. Yep. Peter.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.